So good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning.
And welcome to those who are here for the first time, Hirato and Ash. Not the first time, but first time in quite a while. Yeah. Welcome back. No one else is here for the first time. So, I wonder as, here they come. Good morning. I wonder, have any of you witnessed any miracles lately?
Mm-hmm.
I have. I mean, they might not be the kind of miracles that we typically think of in terms of miracle. I mean, when I say miracle, what comes to mind?
Loaves and fishes.
Yeah, if you grew up going to a Christian church, loaves and fishes. If you grew up in a completely secular family, you may have no idea what loaves and fishes are, but there was the miraculous multiplication of the loaves and fishes to feed all the people who came to hear the teachings of Jesus. What else comes to mind?
The birth of babies for me.
Yeah. Like any baby. An egg. I mean, just how amazing is an egg, any kind of egg that produces a living being, of so many different kinds.
That we're here.
Yeah.
My orchid had a baby.
Your orchid had a baby?
Yeah. Wow. Still has a baby.
Yeah, you know, in the Christian tradition, the virgin birth and the resurrection are central beliefs, right? And those are miraculous, they're said to be miraculous. And of course, often miracles are involve healing, right? Miraculous healing of the sick, the lame, and the blind in various traditions, right? Not just Christian. And then there are the miracles performed by saints, which are often healing. Yeah. I had to check. I Googled to make sure, but that the requirement is two miracles for full sainthood. Two verified miracles. But they don't have to be while you're alive. They can be miracles of healing after the person has died, through a relic, a piece of bone or a piece of coffin to count for sainthood. So these kinds of stories, you know, miraculous healings, supernatural interventions exist in virtually all spiritual traditions around the world. But most of us, having grown up in secular cultures, are more familiar with the language of high-tech medical miracles, right? And I wish I had actually written down, done a study. Like, I've looked for many years at the language used in journalism about high-tech medical miracles, and it is a language of belief, very strongly. I think we almost believe that just a little bit more and we'll beat death. That's it. The language often suggests that. But many of us have been attracted to Buddhist teaching and practice because of its practicality and its rationality. Right? It doesn't threaten our rational materialism too much. What do we make of the story of the Buddha's mother being impregnated by a white elephant and the baby Buddha being born from her side and immediately taking three steps and proclaiming himself enlightened, right? Wonderful story. Probably added, you know, some years later. So before we go any further, let's stop to remember that the Buddha himself did not require his followers to adhere to any creed or any statement of beliefs. To follow the Buddha, you didn't have to believe that he was, you know, his birth was miraculous. He said once to a group of people called the Kalamas, he had, you know, of course, traveled teaching, and this group of people asked him, they said, look, you know, it's just one wise man after another comes through and proclaiming that he's got the answers. How are we to know? They were full of doubt. How are we to know who to follow? And he said, don't go by reports, by legends, by traditions, by scripture, by logical conjecture, by inference, by analogies, by agreement through pondering views, by probability, or by the thought, this contemplative is our teacher. So, you know, don't believe me just because I say. He said, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are unskillful, these qualities are blameworthy, these qualities are criticized by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to harm and suffering, then you should abandon them. And then he repeats that same list, when you know for yourselves that these qualities are skillful, these qualities are blameless, these qualities are praised by the wise, these qualities, when adopted and carried out, lead to welfare and to happiness, then you should practice and cultivate them. But yet, even today, sometimes we hear about spiritual teachers with seemingly miraculous powers. Some years ago, most of you seen Tricycle magazine, and they have sometimes a forum where they'll ask three teachers from different traditions a question, and they asked about this point. Well, you know, what about miraculous powers in Buddhism? And one of the three, a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner or teacher, said, I've met people who have seen teachers perform miracles. And I've seen some things that I would consider quite extraordinary, things that would not happen normally. They're not something that every single person in a room or hundreds of thousands of people in a stadium are all going to experience in exactly the same way. That never happens anyway. The teachings tell us that each individual has their own perspective, that there is no objective reality. What's perceived is based on someone's habitual tendencies of perception. When certain causes and conditions come together, such as a meeting of a teacher and a student in a proper way, a particular student may perceive something extraordinary. That's a miracle. For someone else, it's not. They don't see anything. And then another one of the forum participants said, do we need anything more than everyday events to spur our practice on? If someone close to you is diagnosed with cancer, that will change your practice like nothing else. Seeing someone fly through the air, I don't see how that will affect my practice at all. He said, I've been around Buddhists for 35 years, and I've never seen anything close to what we might call miraculous in that sense of manipulating reality. So it seems to me that these two are a little bit talking at cross purposes, right? Of course, the power of stories and symbolic images has been part of the literature of all religious traditions. There are many tales of the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa flying through the air and combating demons. And in Japanese folklore, there are tales of Kannon Bodhisattva and Jizo Bodhisattva appearing to ordinary people and helping those who are simple, humble, and kind. There's wonderful folk tales along those lines. We tend to think of Zen as being pretty down to earth, but miraculous powers show up even in Zen lore. Bodhidharma, the 6th century Indian monk who brought the Zen practice, introduced Chan practice to China, is said to have crossed the Yangtze River on a reed. You see pictures of him sort of surfing on the reed across the river. the miraculous elements in all these stories have symbolic, allegorical, and pedagogical functions. In non-literate or pre-literate cultures from which these tales and legends arose, stories had the power to capture the attention, the imagination, right? To convey teachings in a sort of lively and accessible way. To the extent that we can appreciate and enjoy this body of lore, legend, and literature will vary depending on our own conditioning, right? Our own comfort levels, our own familiarity with the source cultures. When we think about what we conventionally accept as the real world and what we call the supernatural as beyond the accepted laws of nature as we know it, as we know them, we see that that boundary between those two realms has always been a construct of human culture, right? Changing as human knowledge and worldviews evolve or sometimes devolve. And at the time of these early scriptures in all the major religions, the miraculous or inexplicable events were part of everyday life, right? It was a lot that was inexplicable. Also, in pre-modern cultures, I think experience in dream or trance states were much more, were recognized and appreciated in ways that have been virtually lost to us in our contemporary culture. You know, how often do we bother to pay attention to our dreams, let alone share them with others? But is a rainbow or a lunar eclipse any less breathtaking because we have a scientific explanation for it? Or is a profound dream of healing and connection any more wondrous because we don't know where it came from, how it came to us? In Buddhist practice, our commitment is to deeply investigate the nature of existence, which is impermanent and insubstantial. So one of the third participant in this forum in Tricycle, Judith Leaf, commented, "If you look at reality closely and directly from the meditative perspective, ordinary reality becomes more and more strange and miraculous." And I think we could also turn it just exactly the other way and say the miraculous, the inexplicable, becomes more and more ordinary. The word miracle, after all, comes from the Latin miraculum, meaning object of wonder. So as you said, you've encountered some miracles lately, objects of wonder. Right? Dogen Zenji, the Japanese founder of our stream of Zen, wrote about this in a text he called Miracles, or sometimes translated as Mystical Powers. And he has his own inimitable perspective on this question, so I thought I would share some of it with you. He begins by saying, "The miracles I am speaking of are the daily activities of Buddhists, which they carry out tirelessly." The word here, translated as activities, consists of the two characters, Chinese, Japanese characters, for tea and meals. So these are the activities of everyday life, right? Making tea, making a meal. The daily activities of Buddhas, which they carry out tirelessly. Next, he lists various kinds of miracles. The traditional six mystical powers. The power of mystical transmutation, the power to know others' minds, the power of supernatural vision, the power of supernatural hearing, the power to know past lives, and the power to end excess. So Dogen reframes these mystical powers and says, I'm going to paraphrase, you think these powers are so wonderful, but devas, sorcerers, fighting spirits, and demons can have these powers too. In other words, supernatural powers come with the power to abuse them, so take heed. Then he continues, the six powers of a Buddha are different. He quotes Master Linji, or Rinzai, who says, a Buddha enters form, sound, smell, taste, touch, and objects of mind, and is not confused by them. Thus, a Buddha masters the six sense objects, which are all marked with emptiness. Does this sound like the Heart Sutra, which we're going to chant after this? A Buddha is free of conditions, even having a body of five skandhas. Accompanied by desire, a Buddha does not depend on anything. A Buddha practices miracles which are grounded on earth. Isn't that a beautiful expression? A Buddha practices miracles which are grounded on earth. So a Buddha lives in embodied with the senses. And the skandhas, remember it's the five skandhas, form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. These are kind of the components of our of mind. We have all those, the Buddha has all those, but without getting hooked by, confused by any of those components of our existence. So Dogen's telling us we don't need to achieve special powers or demonstrate them to others. The pitfalls are many. We need to steadily, endlessly investigate the nature of mind and let go of our conditioning. In doing that, we cultivate an awareness of body and mind that allows for flexible, creative responses and connection to the world. And that's what we're going to be talking about through practice period, which is going to start in a couple weeks. Practice period, for those who are new, is an 8-week span where we kind of ramp up our practice, kind of intensify and strengthen. And our theme is going to be living in samsara, samsara being the world of suffering, suffering and resilience. So what is resilience? And it's this cultivation of a flexible mind. Dogen says, Buddhas play in miracles alone. Life becomes nothing but miracles. And then he gives us some examples of this view of mystical powers from the Zen tradition, and he tells this old story from the Chinese tradition of Chan. One day, while Guishan was lying down, Yangshan came to see him. Guishan turned his face to the wall. Guishan is the teacher. Yangshan is the student. Yangshan said, I'm your student. Please don't be formal. Guishan started to get up. Yangshan rose to leave. Guishan said, Yangshan. Yangshan returned. Guishan said, let me tell you about my dream. Yangshan leaned forward to listen. Guishan said simply, would you interpret my dream for me? I want to see how you do it. In response, Yangshan brought a basin of water and a towel. Guishan washed his face and sat up. Then Xiangyan came in. Guishan said, Yangshan and I have been sharing miracles. This is no small matter. Xiangyan said, I was next door and I heard you. Guishan said to him, why don't you try now? Xiangyan made a bowl of tea and brought it to him. Guishan praised them, saying, you two students surpass even Shariputra and Moggallana, with your miraculous activity. So it sounds kind of, it's one of these stories of Chinese Zen masters and their students just being a little crazy. But they're being playful, they're teasing each other, and they're thoroughly enjoying themselves. Offering and receiving a basin of water and a towel, sharing a pot of tea. These are everyday miracles. They don't need to show off their Zen understanding. They're just playing with miracles. When he says, you two students surpass even Shariputra and Moggallana, they were two of the Buddha's most eminent disciples. And I'm pretty sure that Moggallana was one who was known for his kind of supernatural capacities. Yeah, so saying you're even better than them. Dogen refers to these mystical powers such as clairvoyance and clairsentience, the list I just gave you. He calls them minor miracles. Because, he says, they're limited by circumstances, they depend on special practices and realizations. They may occur in this lifetime, but not in another lifetime. They may be available to some people, but not to others. They may appear in this land, but not elsewhere. They may appear at times other than the present moment, but not this present moment. He says, great miracles are not like that. So these are minor miracles. So what are great miracles? He cites the famous Zen master Pang, who was a Chinese layman who lived in the 7th century. He wasn't a monk, but he practiced with some of the great Zen masters of his time, and he was greatly respected by all. And he said, miracles are nothing other than fetching water and carrying firewood. And that has become a famous line. So Dogen cites that line and says that causing water to pour out of the head is merely a minor miracle, a limited achievement, but fetching water and carrying firewood are great miracles. Then he even goes further. He says that even when we don't notice that fetching water and carrying firewood are miracles, they are undeniably miracles. Even when we do not recognize that miracles, this is Dogen, even when we do not recognize that miracles happen 3,000 times in the morning and 8,000 times in the evening, in other words, all the time, miracles are actualized. What do you think he means?
That they're happening every moment, yeah. Whether we're paying attention or not.
Even when we're kind of oblivious. Life manifesting is miraculous, yeah. He says, those who see and hear the wondrous activities of miracles by Buddha do not fail to attain the way. So I don't think he's saying that the Buddhas are some kind of supernatural beings performing miracles, but that existence is the continuous manifestation of Buddha nature. Then he tells of a sorcerer who approached the Buddha and asked, you have 6 miraculous powers and I have 5. What is the one I'm missing? To which the Buddha replied, what miraculous power are you talking about? I don't think the Buddha was being disingenuous here. I think he was prodding the sorcerer to go beyond keeping score. You know how we do that. Oh, that person got that job and I didn't get it. You know, that person got better reviews and I got a lukewarm review. Right? We're always keeping score. That's what the sorcerer was doing. Another old story, Zen Master Dongshan gave a similar nudge to his attendant, Yunyan. Yunyan asked, what are miraculous powers? Dongshan just put his hands in Shashu like this. And then Yunyan wasn't satisfied. He wanted to, what are miraculous powers? And Dongshan bowed and walked away. He was not going to get hooked into giving a limited answer to a limitless question. Dogen quotes another old Chinese master, Baijan, who said, "The eyes, ears, nose, and tongue are not defiled by form or formlessness. Leaving no trace in the six sense organs is called the six types of miracles. Not to be hindered by either form or formlessness and not to depend on intellectual understanding are miracles. Not abiding in these miracles is called going beyond miracles." So here he's saying, don't even get stuck in seeing everything as a miracle. A bodhisattva who goes beyond miracles does not leave traces. This is a person going beyond Buddha. It is a most wondrous person. So he's, of course, talking about the miracle of liberation, of freedom, not being bound by form or formlessness, not living in this human body of six senses so fully that we leave no trace, no residue of clinging or aversion. And we don't have to think of this as some far distant goal, lifetimes away. It's actually a freedom that is available to us in each moment of full presence, full awareness. So I'll tell you my little miracle from last week. I was sitting, friends gave us an old-fashioned kind of garden swing. It's on a frame, and we've been eating lunch out on the garden swing, and it's in the back of our yard. So I was, and Michael had gone in, and I was just sitting there reading for a while after lunch because I've really gotten to like this garden swing. I was listening to the chickadees, because we live out in the country, for those who don't know, past Maple Ridge. And I was listening to the chickadees, and they're all little different. Chickadees do a lot more than just chickadee-dee-dee. They have lots of different calls and meanings. And then I heard this other little chip-chip that wasn't a chickadee. So I looked, and it was this bright yellow little warbler. It's called a Wilson's warbler, and has a little black cap and a beady little black eyes, and bright, bright yellow. And it was just rustling around in the salal bushes, just like right here. And that's to my right. And to my right is the wild. There's a wetland there, so it's quite wild. And to my left is the garden. So I looked at this little guy. And then I looked over here, and we have just this bonanza of sunflowers this year. And it was exactly the same yellow. It was this yellow miracle. It was just so yellow. So sometimes an everyday miracle is a cup of tea. Sometimes it's an eagle soaring overhead just when you're feeling really discouraged. Sometimes it's sitting with a very old or a very ill person just quietly breathing together. So when we think about resilience, you know, how to live in a very difficult, painful world, this capacity, Michael called it last week in his talk, this capacity to meet the world as it is, just as it is, and to choose to do that. Without needing to manipulate the world to meet our expectations. I think this is really key to being able to live in the world as it is. And that when we can do this, each breath, each moment, each taste, sight, sound, and touch is the miracle of being alive. So I'm going to read you a poem to close by the great American poet Walt Whitman, who knew something about miracles, and was something of a bodhisattva himself, with his vast love of life. And this poem is called Miracles. Why, who makes much of a miracle? As to me, I know nothing else but miracles. Whether I walk the streets of Manhattan or dart my sight over the roofs of houses toward the sky, or wade with naked feet along the beach just in the edge of the water, or stand under trees in the woods, or talk by day with anyone I love, or sleep in the bed at night with anyone I love, or sit at table at dinner with the rest, or look at strangers opposite me riding in the car, or watch honeybees busy around the hive of a summer forenoon, or animals feeding in the fields, or birds, or the wonderfulness of insects in the air, or the wonderfulness of the sundown, or of stars shining so quiet and bright, or the exquisite, delicate, thin curve of the new moon in spring. These, with the rest, one and all, are to me miracles, the whole referring, yet each distinct and in its place. To me, every hour of the light and dark is a miracle. Every cubic inch of space is a miracle. Every square yard of the surface of the earth is spread with the same. Every foot of the interior swarms with the same. To me, the sea is a continual miracle. The fishes that swim, the rocks, the motion of the waves, the ships with the men in them. What stranger miracles are there? May you keep your senses open and find some miracles in the days to come.
Do you do the chant to close the Dharma talk on page 3?
May our intentions equally extend.